Hey everyone, it's MJ from the Edit Bay here. This episode features a lot of our own creatures' input about this film, so sorry about that. Just thought I'd give you a heads up. Not a lot we could do when dogs and kitty cats are barking and meowing over our talking, so...
Hey everyone, and welcome to Let's Jaws for a Minute, the podcast that took a deep dive into Steven Spielberg's 1975 masterpiece and is now setting sail into uncharted waters to discover the world beyond Jaws. I'm Sarah Budgery.
And I'm MJ Smith, and monster movie season rolls on with another 1950s classic of the genre, a film called Creature from the Black Lagoon. Where did you watch Creature from the Black Lagoon, Sarah?
So I am a fancy lad, or ladette, I suppose, and finally treated myself to the Blu-ray box set thing. My justification was that two of the films we're covering in this season were on it. But I didn't need much justification. It's a really pretty set. It's like your 4K, but I think there's 8 films, and the Blu-ray not 4K. But yeah, that is where I watched it. But unlike some of the other films we've watched in this series, this is very readily available. Amazon, Sky Store, YouTube, Google Play, all those places where you can stream things. Pay to rent, rather than... There's no free streaming options that I could see, but certainly options where you can pay to rent it. So yes, more readily available than than our large radioactive sun.
Sure. I am also a fancy lad, and I treated myself to volume 2 of the Universal Monsters 4Ks, which is
very nice.
The Mummy, Bride of Frankenstein, Phantom of the Opera, and Creature from the Black Lagoon. So I watched it on 4K, and it looked amazing.
I bet it looked so pretty. Yeah. It looked so nice in Blu-ray, and I was like, oh, I bet this in 4K is like, ugh.
Yeah, it looked like it came out yesterday. It was ridiculous. But yeah, it's available on all the rentable places. It's not streaming anywhere, but you can, yeah, it's like $4 to rent it on Apple, Amazon, Google, YouTube, all the places where you rent stuff here. So it's, yeah, pretty easily accessible. And like, I think you can trip over DVDs of this as well. Yeah, it's very, very easy to come by. The synopsis is that a strange prehistoric beast lurks in the depths of the Amazonian jungle. A group of scientists try to capture the animal and bring it back to civilization for study. It was directed by Jack Arnold, stars Richard Carlson, Julie Adams, Richard Denning, Antonio Moreno, and Nestor Paiva. Also, Rico Browning and Bob Chapman played the creature. Bob Chapman played him on land, and Rico Browning did all the underwater work, which is outstanding. And we will talk about that. But Sarah, was this a first time watch for you?
It was. I'm so surprised by how few of these like classic monster movies I've seen, but gone on a real journey the last, like, I don't want to like set my head too far, but like I feel like this might be my favorite not Jaws season that we've done. I'm just really enjoying it. Like every film I'm sure there'll be some duds, but like, well, I mean The Blob wasn't great, but
sure,
every film that I've watched so far for kind of like the main season, I've just like not even just loved, but been like so excited by how much I love it.
Yeah, this is the second time I've seen it, and it's great, man. Like, it's just, It is so much fun. It was funny. I was thinking about The Blob a lot because this is also a perfect drive-in movie, but for the exact opposite reasons why The Blob is a perfect drive-in movie. The pacing of it, I think, is what like really sets it apart between as a drive-in movie between this and The Blob, where it's just like stuff is constantly happening. It's always moving forward. They get right to the chase of like, all right, we're tracking down the fish boy. Like, it's just, it gets you in, gets it done. It looks great. It's shot really well. The set looks amazing, despite it taking place pretty much in one location. All the underwater stuff is mind-blowing. Like, thinking about them capturing that footage in 1954 and then also watching the creature move around underwater is just like, what? How'd they do that? It's such a fun time to watch. It's like an hour and 20 minutes. Like, it's not hard to watch. Nothing. At all.
Yeah, this was great. And I was a bit worried going into it because I'd enjoyed Frankenstein, King Kong, and Godzilla so much. I was like, maybe this is going to be the one that, you know, doesn't live up to it, because people don't really talk about this film in the same way that they talk about those others. It's clearly an incredibly influential film, and we will get into that.
Yeah.
Boy, will we get into it, because particularly with our film, the reason why we're here, Jaws, there is hella lot of Creature from the Black Lagoon in Jaws, some more overt than others. I think everyone knows about the Spielberg literally like repurposing the creature's noise for both Duel and Jaws,
right?
In the sort of like the death of a truck, but you know, like the final scene when the truck's going over the cliff in Duel, Spielberg used the noise from Creature from the Black Lagoon. So it's clearly very, very influential. What's so interesting is like when I was looking, doing some research, and there's a whole like Wikipedia page that's like the cultural impact of Creature from the Black Lagoon, and Jaws isn't mentioned once.
That's wild.
And I was like, are we blind? Like, I don't understand that. But what's really funny is that on our Godzilla episode, our last episode, I think Chris said that like Frankenstein plus King Kong plus Godzilla almost equals Jaws. The only element that's missing is like the men on the boat dynamic.
Yeah.
We got Surprise! It.
Yep.
Here it is.
That's a Jaws, baby. Like.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's. No, go.
Oh, I was thinking the exact same thing. It was so funny that, Chris's quote from last episode was in my brain. And I was just like, well, there it is. Found him.
We've found a Jaws.
Yep, we have officially Frankenstein to Jaws from these four movies.
Yeah, maybe I think let's just get right into it, because I mean, most people are here for listening to us talk about Jaws.
Right.
So just how influential this film was on Jaws. Obviously, we've spoken about Jaws a lot in the previous episodes in this season, that you can sort of certainly take elements from those films. But there are some shots in this film that are straight up like redone in Jaws. And I love it. It doesn't feel kind of like, oh, he copied that, like, to me. It's just like, no, you could imagine Spielberg loving this film when he was younger, loving these classic Universal monster movies, and then he got to make his own. Like, that's so cool that he got to do that, having loved these films. But there's, I mean, the shot of kind of like, I guess it's from like the creature POV, kind of looking up at Kay swimming. We get that again in Jaws. There's a lot of stuff with the winch and kind of how they shoot that as well, where the winch is breaking when they're trying to capture the creature. Even just like small little things, like there's a bit where David approaches Kay on the boat and makes her jump, and I'm just like, that's Ellen and Brody. Like, it's just I can't believe that I, as a person who loves Jaws as much as I do, and you know, someone who loves Jaws so much that it's basically my entire personality now, that this was a film I hadn't seen before. I was certainly aware of it. Like, I've read things where Spielberg has talked about films that he loves and that influenced him, and this is clearly one of them.
Yeah.
But I can't believe it's taken me this long to watch it. There's so much Jaws in this. It's actually kind of ridiculous. I mean, was there anything that I haven't mentioned that you picked up on?
Where Marg and David are sitting on the rowboat waiting for the creature to show up, and Mark's the one that wants to kill the creature, right?
Yeah, the blonde guy.
The blonde guy, yeah. Mark has this harpoon gun, and he's sitting there waiting for the creature, and he goes, come on, come on. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, yeah. Roy Scheider full on stole that.
Yeah.
He says it exactly like the same.
The weapon they use looks kind of similar to Hooper's, like, dart repeater thing that he takes down into the cage with him. Who's the captain on the boat? He was great. Is it Lucas? Is that his name?
Yeah.
A lot of Quint in that.
Yeah.
the kind of his wisecracks, just his general sort of like attitude and his approach to the whole mission. Like, not exactly the same. I mean, there's not one character in this where you kind of go, there's your Hooper, there's your Quint, there's your Brody. It's kind of like those three in Jaws are an amalgamation of a lot of the characters in this. I think you can see a lot of similarities between David, who is kind of like the main guy, and Brody, the sort of like the everyman. But even then, he's got elements of Hooper because he's a scientist of some description, like studies fossils and rocks and under the water and all that business. So yeah, it's I like that it isn't that clear cut, that it's not like there's your Brody, there's your Quint, there's your Hooper. It's just like you can recognize traits from the characters in Creature from the Black Lagoon in the characters in Jaws.
they like pared down the cast, right? Because it's like five or six people, or maybe even seven, on the boat at a given time. But you can tell, like, which elements they took. Because, there's this point towards the end where, like, Mark and David are really, like, at two different ideological ends, much like Quint and Hooper. And, you know, David wants to research the Gill Man. Mark just wants to kill it. And David's the one who put together the team. And so he tells Lucas, like, hey, we got to get out of here. And then Mark's like, no, we got to stay here and kill this thing. And Lucas is like, no, he was like, I don't know how it works on land, but out here on the water, like, El Capitan makes the, and I was just like, Hooper drives the boat, chief. Like,
yeah, it's kind of nuts. Like, fortunately I was watching this by myself, because I think Martin would have been so annoyed with, like, how many times I said, it was like yours, in this, because
even the music,
the bits. Right? Yeah. There was a bit as well where I was just like, hang on, if you strip this music back a little bit and maybe slow it down, it's basically Jaws music.
There's a bit when they're swimming underwater, like right before they encounter the creature for the first time, where it's like Mark and David are down there. It's before Kay does her swim where the creature starts stalking her. And I was just like, this is Jaws. Like, that's Jaws music. That's ridiculous.
There's even similar shots of, like, the very, very opening of Jaws, where we're in the shark's POV. There's shots like that in this, where it is not as clear that you're in the creature POV, but just kind of, like, the movement through the water. There's that feeling that we are looking at things from the creature's eyes, particularly when we don't see him as well. And just because it's not the sea, it's a lagoon, isn't it?
Right.
How that's, the bottom of that is shot, and the kind of like the camera movement through that was very, very like the beginning of Jaws, and paired with the music being so similar to Jaws as well. I'm just like, I can't believe that this 70-year-old film exists that has got so many elements that are in my favorite film of all time, and I'm only just watching it now. Like, it's kind of mind blown.
And also, like, when the Gill Man first attacks the two guys that were helping the Richard Hammond part, like, there's Jurassic Park in this too, for sure. like, when the creature attacks them, that's straight up the beginning of Jurassic Park, with the like the cage shaking with the raptor in it. Like, you see the tent mm-hmm. shaking as the Gilman attacks them. Yeah, it's wild that, like, Spielberg fucking loves this movie, you can tell. There's elements of The Lost World in it with them, like, capturing the Gilman and putting him in the cage on the boat, mm-hmm. which is also probably a King Kong reference. Like,
yeah,
it is, you know, obviously having the creature obsessed with the girl, that's a King Kong reference. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, it's wild at, like, the nexus point it is of, like, the monster movies up to that point, and then where monster movies are going to go as Spielberg takes up the torch of, like, making big budget blockbustery monster films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of wish we were staying in this decade a bit long, or this, like, era of monster movies a bit longer, because we take a big jump into the 80s for our next episode. But also I'm conscious that there were a lot of kind of copycat monster films around this time, ones that just weren't as good, a lot of kind of cash-in sequels as well, where they were like, hey, the first one did really well, let's just make another one. So I'm happy with the ones that we've watched, but also now I've got that little 8 Blu-ray box set of some really great classic monster movies. You better believe I'm gonna go and watch them.
Yeah. Is Bride of Frankenstein in the...
It is, okay. Yeah. It's that, Invisible Man, Dracula, which Martin is desperate for me to watch.
So good.
A bunch of others as well that I can't remember. Wolfman, maybe? Mm-hmm. Phantom of the Opera.
Okay, that sounds like the 8 that I like between the 2 volumes of the 4K set, that sounds like the 8 that they have, like the 8 main ones.
Yeah, I think it's basically the same. I think we have maybe one of the 4K ones over here, possibly, if not both of them. Did the second part come out recently? Or?
Within the last year or so.
Okay. Yeah, maybe we have got both of them then. But yeah, like, watching... I feel like once I've watched those 8 films on there, I will have such, like, a good idea of just this, like, subgenre as a whole. It's clearly a genre that I love, because I love Jaws, but just the how it shaped cinema as we know it is just kind of mind-blowing to me.
Well, even, like, it's wild because I was reading about, like, the other movies that Jack Arnold had directed, and he directed the sequel, Revenge of the Creature, and Clint Eastwood's in that movie. That's his first on-screen appearance.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
Yep. It turns out, also, Jack Arnold directed a movie that, like, I can't say the name of on here, because it is Boss, racial slur for black people, but it was a big-time blaxploitation movie. Like, when I did my paper on exploitation movies, that movie came up a lot. Because it was one of those blaxploitation movies that starred, like, a former football player, but the Fred Williamson. Fred Williamson also wrote the movie, and it's a parody of the Man with No Name movies, which is very funny. But yeah, it was wild because I, one, didn't assume a movie with that title would have been directed by a white guy. but yeah, he, like, made his name in this sort of, like, B-movie subgenre, because... I like Creature from the Black Lagoon's a B movie. Like, it's great, but it's a B movie.
Yeah, which I think is why going into it I was a little concerned that it wouldn't be that good. I was kind of like, oh no, like, the effect's gonna be really bad. I mean, it's very clearly a dude in a rubber fishman suit, and I'm actually okay with that. I mean, I'm always charmed, I think, by practical effects, and I think when it looks as pretty as it does and has so much other great stuff about it, it doesn't quite get to the same levels of thematic richness that I think we've had in the previous three films we've talked about in this series. There is definitely, so it continues some of those ideas explored in those films, and we'll get into that, but it's, I don't know, I was just expecting it to, like, look and feel cheap. Like, it clearly, you know, the sets look like sets. The kind of, like, the grotto thing or whatever at the end. I'm like, okay, yeah, very clearly, like, plaster walls and stuff. But I kind of love that. And I always love a film that is can still have an impact, even if it's, you know, you can see a little of the man behind the curtain. Like, even though you can see, like, that's a set, that's a guy in a fish suit. I mean, we saw it in Godzilla as well. Like, there's tiny little moments where, you know, like, I know that's a man in a big lizard suit stomping on a little toy truck, but it doesn't matter because it's still great.
Yeah, I also think the suit's great. Like, the creature design is just cool. It looks rad. Mm-hmm. And, like, seeing the gills work on it in conjunction with him gasping for air with, like, a big tongue. Like, it's neat. It's a neat effect. And, like, it looks a little cheap, but then also watching it cut through the water and see how they designed the suit to be in the water. Like, it is clear that they the on land stuff was secondary, and the reason the suit looks the way it does is so that it can function in the water. And it looks amazing in the water. Like, the scene where Kay is swimming and he's swimming parallel to her, it's so cool. It's so cool. And just, like, also the sheer, like, athleticism of Rico Browning, who did all the water stunts, is crazy.
Well, what did we discover about the man in the fish suit? Or what did I discover about the man in the fish suit?
He's hot.
He is a legit snack.
Yeah.
Please Google this if you don't believe me. Specifically the underwater stuntman. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the other guy because, hilariously, his photo on Wikipedia is the fish man.
Yeah.
And not
he. Okay. Who he is what I will say about the Bob Chapman is the guy who played the land creature for the land scenes. Mm-hmm. That dude is 6'5", and there's a scene towards the end of the movie when they're, like, confronting the creature in the grotto where he picks up Mark by the hips and lifts him above his head, like, and I was like, I don't think I could do that to the smallest person I know. Because he just walks up to him, like, just grabs him by the... And even if there were wires to help with that, like, that's still, like, you... Mm. It's crazy. By the hips, like, that's not where the center of gravity, like... in the suit, like...
Yeah.
And Mark's not a... Like, he's a built dude. Like, he's stocky. Like, it was wild. I was just like, he lifted that motherfucker up by the hips. Like, that's crazy. Or even when he's carrying Kay around and he's just got her by the hips, which must have hurt her back, but, you know, he's just, like, got her not even around the waist, it's literally by the hips, which means her, like, she's more top heavy than she is bottom heavy at that point, and like, he's just walking around with her like it's nothing. Like, how strong was that guy?
Yeah, the incredibly impressive performances from both of the guys in the suit, and the underwater as well. I was reading that because of the design of the suit, there were times when he was having to hold his breath for like 4 minutes underwater because they didn't want you to be able to see like bubbles and stuff, because, like, I don't know exactly how to explain it, but like with gills and stuff, you don't get bubbles, that kind of expelling of air like you do with a person breathing underwater. But obviously it is a person. So to, like, keep up the illusion, or at least most of the time anyway, they had this guy holding his breath and performing underwater. Like, he is still giving a performance. Mm-hmm. There's moments, I think particularly the underwater photography in this film is breathtaking. Yeah. Like, the bit when he is stalking Kay, incredible. Like, obviously there's the Jaws parallels, which make me very happy, but just... The way it is shot, the way it shoots her, the way it shoots the creature, the way it shoots both of them together. Amazing. And I think I've got a few, like, favorite shots in the film. Like, that's for sure one of them. But when they have the creature captured and on the boat, and you just see his, like, weird little fish head, like, poking out, it looks so sinister. And for a film that is, like, a man in a rubber fishman suit, obviously there's times when it looks like a little silly,
right?
But the illusion worked for me because there were moments like that. Like that moment when you just see the hand come out.
So good.
Terrifying. The moment when you see the creature's like face for the first time, actually a pretty effective jump scare. I jumped because I just wasn't, I was like, we're going to see him at some point. But like with so many of these films, there was that effective build up to seeing the creature. I mean, it's, I think it's only like 4 minutes before we see his hand, but until we see him in like in full, if you will, it's over 20 minutes into the film that you then kind of see his face, see his body. So that was startling to see that for the first time. And then that great shot of him sort of like in the cage, like on the boat, just like lying, waiting. So creepy. Yeah. Like it really, that helped to sell the illusion for me. That made me, for even for a brief moment, be like, okay, this isn't a man in a suit, this is a monster. So I imagine for audiences in 1954 it would have worked like even better.
Yeah. So do you know the history of the creature design?
I read a little, but I'm happy to hear again.
Right. So Millicent Patrick is the one who designed the creature. However, she was not the credited creature designer. It went to Bud Westmore, who ran Universal Studios' makeup department. And then in 1978, there was an article in Famous Monsters of Filmland that talked about her work on designing not just creatures, but creatures in general, just like her work with movie monsters, because she worked in the Universal makeup department. But it was not until 2019 that author Mallory O'Meara published a book called The Lady from the Black Lagoon and definitively proved that Patrick was the sole designer of the Gill Man.
Nice.
So, but they, like, it was weird. They did, like, they did send her out to do press about the creation of the monster. So, like, they clearly said that she had something to do with it, and then they just credited the guy.
I mean, I wish it was different now, but...
Yeah. Yeah. But, this is from Millicent Patrick's Wikipedia. She used to work for Disney, by the way. So the press tour was called The Beauty Who Created the Beast. And then Bud Westmore, the credited creature designer, called it, changed the name to The Beauty Who Lives with the Beast, because the implication that she created the creature was in the title of that press tour. And he didn't like that. Oh, and then she got fired over that.
Classic. Well, justice for Millicent in the end.
Also, Mallory O'Meara, a good follow on the socials.
Okay, I'll have to look into that. The design of it, I think, really works. I mean, as you said, like, particularly when you see it in the water. And one thing I was reading about the design of it is obviously not just having two different guys playing, you know, the stuff in the water and the stuff on the land, is the color of the suit was slightly different. So the water suit was lighter, I guess, to sort of like reflect the natural light in the water or something, and the one on land is darker. And they put more into the suit in water, even though because it's in water you don't see it as well, obviously. Like, you really see the detail of the suit when it's on land.
Yeah.
But I love that attention to detail. Yeah. I love that it's like, we know that this creature is, even though it can be land or water, like, it looking good in water is the priority. So focusing on that, but then obviously having something that can work on land as well. The creature looks goofier on land than it does water, sure. But I think that's just kind of to be expected. And I'm not mad at it.
No, I think it adds to the charm and also makes it feel very much like the drive-in experience it's supposed to. You know, like, this is it. Here's the thing. The thing we haven't mentioned is this was shot in 3D, right? Like, it wasn't shot in 3D, but it was released in 3D. And so it was supposed to be like a cheap thrills type of movie, right? Which is why there's not a lot going on under the hood of this thing. Because it wasn't supposed to have that, right? Yeah. Like, it was supposed to be this big, pretty looking movie that like comes out at you quite literally off the screen with like pretty people in it. And so for that, it works great. But Jack Arnold's a pretty good director, so a lot of the shots are like really cool. There's a scene at night that's like a tracking shot of just like everyone standing on the boat waiting for the creature to show up, and it's so dope. It's so cool. It's just this, like, the blocking of that scene is really great. The way the camera tracks across the boat is really great. Like, it keeps things interesting the whole time, despite the fact that we're largely just on the boat or in the water. And then twice we go into the grotto. It's still like, it's got that Jaws on the Orca thing where it's still like, you see every angle of this boat. Cause the boat's not that big. I mean, it's maybe the size of the Orca, maybe a little bit bigger, but not by a lot.
A little bigger. Yeah.
And it still doesn't feel like, oh, we're back on the boat. You know, like he found every angle to do it. And then even the moments where the creature does hop on board, like, he keeps finding new ways to reveal the creature getting onto the boat, which could be a gag that wears thin really easily, but he found enough dynamic ways to do it. Like that first shot of just the hand and the knee through the window is so cool.
Yeah, it's great that like the influence on Jaws is evident, not just in Spielberg being like, I'm gonna make my own film about a, you know, creature that lives in water. It's like in the way that it's shot and in the, particularly in the scenes on the boat or the things that use the boat, in making that thing look freaking huge. Yeah. I mean, they do that on the Orca as well, to the point where you're kind of like, when you actually see the whole boat, you're like, is that it? Yeah. Like, because it's, you just see that little cabin, but obviously there's underneath and there's all different angles, and they do a similar thing in this as well, where it's just like, and the effect of that is that you don't know where the creature is going to pop up from, and exactly like you're saying as well, finding new ways to use the boat and new ways to introduce the creature. It's not just like, they can't just have that area covered, like where the ladder is that goes down or something, right? Because that's where the creature comes up from, because this, it finds new ways to sort of approach, so they're having to like keep their wits about them, and then that makes it more exciting, because you, like I said, you just don't know where it's gonna come from next. And you get that with the shark in Jaws as well, because obviously this thing has got the whole ocean to to swim around in, but you just don't know where it's gonna pop up from next, because you kind of see it everywhere, which is great.
Yeah.
And it's
it's also Alien, right? Like,
yeah. Well, Alien is Jaws as well.
Yeah.
Space Jaws.
Yeah, that's true. But like, I was thinking about it, like, there's a body burn in this movie, right? Like, the creature catches on fire at some point and jumps in the water and puts himself out, and like the xenomorph catches on fire, and like, there's a really famous body burn in Alien. And so I was just like, whoa, this is like, yes, for as much as everyone talks about like Alien was a big, or Jaws was a big influence on Alien, there's plenty of influence of Creature from the Black Lagoon in Alien as well, which couldn't be a more different movie.
Yeah, this Creature from the Black Lagoon feels like the kind of film that basically influenced everyone who made a monster movie after this, but they don't want to admit that this was the film that influenced them, because I see it in so many other films. I mean, we'll get to Del Toro, because he is obviously very vocal about how influential this film was on him and a certain film. But for other directors who have sort of like had their stab at making like a monster movie or a creature feature or whatever, they'll quote the Frankensteins, the King Kongs, mm-hmm. the Godzillas, that sort of thing. But like, I just don't feel like you see as many directors talking about this film, to the point where, like I said, Jaws isn't even mentioned on that freaking Wikipedia page mm-hmm. about like the cultural impact of Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah.
Like, is everyone blind?
Yeah, it's so obvious.
It doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Yeah, it's plain as day, right? Like, it's like I said, it's through Spielberg's entire career, just every bit of like mysterious creature reveal comes from the Creature from the Black Lagoon. Like, it's all in there. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, it is funny to see how sort of like King Kong the movie is too, where it's like people exploring an unknown region, mm-hmm. finding a mysterious creature, fucking with it for some reason, and then and then the creature falls in love with a woman. Like, mm-hmm. even when like they go to the grotto and they like Kay is just sitting there like passed out on the rock, it looks like King Kong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can see elements of all the films that we've spoken about so far in this. And even though there isn't that, like I was saying earlier, there isn't that same richness and depth to the themes in this, it is a film that is intended for like the drive-in crowd, mm-hmm. and you know, to be exciting. And I mean, the pacing of this is just incredible. Mm-hmm. More films should be an hour and 20.
Yeah.
But through all of the films that we've spoken about so far, and I think this is probably where this is going to end based on what our next film is probably a good place to talk about this as sort of like to, you know, bookend this part of monster movie season. What all of these four films that we've spoken about so far have in common is humans being the real monsters. Mm-hmm. That's to a lesser extent in this, but definitely mm-hmm. still prevalent. Mm-hmm. The monsters also aren't really monsters. There's a degree throughout these four films of misunderstanding of the creature or the monster's intent, and the argument of, are they really a monster who is just like, rah, kill everyone, or are they kind of just like, hey, you're in my house, yeah. get out. And also the monster, or I guess particularly how the humans treat the monsters, is representative of a lot of sort of like different aspects of human nature or various characteristics. I mean, we see in Frankenstein this idea of just like the kind of god complex that we see in Henry Frankenstein. This wanting to meddle in Hank Frank, there it is, the wanting to meddle in things that shouldn't mm-hmm. be meddled with, but also how judgmental humans are, or judging something that is unfamiliar to them or different to them. This gets complicated when we get to Godzilla, but still this idea of like man's part to play in creating these monsters, if you will, is one of the major things in Godzilla.
Yeah.
The ancient creature aspect as well. I hope some of that makes sense. But yeah, I think this will be a good place to like talk about those similarities that we've seen in these four films, because I imagine they may come back, but I imagine they stop with our next film.
Potentially, so. yeah, right. Like, okay, so that brings me to this question. Is the Gill Man a kaiju?
I mean, does it depend on like the definition? Do they have to be of like a certain size?
No.
Kaiju?
The term kaiju just translates to strange beast.
Then I guess.
Yeah.
Because all we really know or find out about the creature is that, because at the beginning it's set up like the creation of the earth, mm-hmm. and then it's like the creatures that evolved mm-hmm. to move from sea to land, and maybe there's still some that can, you know, mm-hmm. do both or whatever. So it's this idea, this ancient creature that is perhaps only in this lagoon in the middle mm-hmm. of the Amazon, you know, people just haven't discovered or found up to this point. So I guess, I mean, it's like they don't seem to understand like what this beast is.
Yeah. There is also a term called Kaijin, which translates mm-hmm. to mysterious person. But I don't think the Gilman is a person, right? Like, I don't think that this thing demonstrates any sort of like higher thinking capability.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Yeah. Nothing going on between the gills.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing. Yeah.
Well,
nothing there.
You say that, but then there's some degree of like, not really human emotion, but he clearly treats or approaches Kay in a very different way to how he approaches the guys.
And he's sort of Kong
in this. Yeah.
But no one would call Kong a Kaijin.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess by the very definition of either term, then yes.
Yeah.
He is. But yeah. I don't. I think more beast-like than human-like, mm-hmm. based on the kind of seeming lack of thinking capacity.
Yeah, Hagrid agrees. yeah, I. And then that leads me to this, which is why'd Guillermo make the lady fuck the dude in his version?
Well, have you read... I can't wait to read this quote out to you, and I really hope you haven't read it already. So, Del Toro is like a huge fan
right.
of Creature from the Black Lagoon. To the point where he was... When they were sort of looking at remaking uh-huh. all of the Universal Monster movies, he was attached to direct
right.
a remake.
Right.
So, Shape of Water started out as like a remake of...
Right.
Creature from the Black Lagoon. What I found out is he said he'd hoped to do a story focused more on the creature's viewpoint while also letting him have a successful romantic liaison. Listen to this quote, because I cannot stress this enough. This is Guillermo del Toro's words from an LA Times interview. He said, I can't believe I'm about to read this out. Okay. I've had this movie in my head since I was 6, not as a story, but as an idea. When I saw the creature swimming under Julie Adams in Creature from the Black Lagoon, I thought three things. I thought, hubba hubba. I thought, this is the most poetic thing I'll ever see. I was overwhelmed by the beauty. And the third thing I thought is, I hope they end up together. So basically, yes. Six? Year old Guillermo.
So this
del
is just Guillermo del Toro's sexual awakening put to film.
I don't know how I feel about that as an idea, but like when you sent me the text that's like, Del Toro really just watched this film and was like, what if she fucks the fish?
Dude. I mean, like, okay. I don't love that movie. Like, it's fine, I think. Like,
sure.
I don't know. Guillermo's mostly miss for me. Like, he's got good ideas, but, like, Pan's Labyrinth and Crimson Peak are the only two that I really revisit with any regularity.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. Someone called him Mexican Tim Burton one time, and I've never been able to shake that.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, because it's like, his films tend to be like a dark twist on a kind of like a classic
mm-hmm.
idea or mm-hmm. like a classic story kind of thing. I mean, Pan's Labyrinth is like what if fairy tale, but mm-hmm. dark and also war.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
right. But like, I just think that like people think there's a lot going on thematically in his movies, and there kind of isn't in my brain. Like, but like,
oh, I don't want to get canceled.
Yeah, I don't know. I just he's fine, right? Like, I don't think he's a bad filmmaker by any stretch. Oh, I really like Nightmare Alley. I forgot he made that, but I really liked that movie a lot. But that's a movie that like I remember when that
that's a remake.
It is a remake, but I also remember when that movie came out. Everyone was like, "Damn, the twist at the end of that movie!" And I was like, "I'm sorry, this movie pauses itself like 30 minutes in to be like, and then this is going to happen in this movie. Like,
yep.
That movie very, very explicitly explains itself and like takes a break from itself to look directly in the camera. And I think it's Willem Dafoe looks down the barrel of the camera and is like, this is what you're going to see for the next. Now that we've got the first act out of the way, here's how the rest of this is going to go down. Let's resume the film Nightmare Alley. Like, it's good. Yeah. I think Bradley Cooper's really good in that movie, but it doesn't have as much going on, I think, as people think it does. Like, which is fine. Like, if he just wants to parade around like a bunch of creatures, that's cool. Like, his creature work is amazing. Like, I'm not gonna take that away from him. It's great. You know, but even like the Pinocchio looks amazing. His Pinocchio movie, it's too fucking long. Like,
too long.
Way too long. And it's just like, he's remaking Frankenstein this year, right? And it's like, you already did it. Like, it's called Pinocchio. Like, Pinocchio, you just took Frankenstein and made a Pinocchio. That's it. That's all you did.
Yeah, I think I'm probably like higher on Del Toro than you are by the sounds of it, but what you're saying resonates. I don't think necessarily that his name attached to a project is kind of the instant stamp of approval that like a lot of people think it is. Like, I've seen people very excited about his take on Frankenstein, and I'm like, why?
Yeah.
Because for all the reasons we've already said, like, he already made it or has been making it for his entire career, almost. We've already got the best version of Frankenstein. It's called the 1931 version.
And we got the second best version, and it's called Young Frankenstein.
Exactly, which I can say now that I've seen it. But we joke about, you know, the Shape of Water is basically just like, yeah, what if the lady and the creature ended up together and they fucked? Mm-hmm. But The Shape of Water basically just is this film.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's just,
I mean, it takes place in a lab, right? Like, so this is sort of like what happens after they get the creature back, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, I don't need that story. You know what I mean? Like, I don't care. That movie won Best Picture.
Wild. Yeah. I still can't believe that like the Academy were like, oh yeah, the fish fucking movie,
it
sounds good.
Yeah. it doesn't make any sense to be like, I thought it was fine. Like, I don't know, he like, and then he has this thing which I think is really pretentious. He says that like he always likes to, he says that he hates the idea of eye candy and he likes to fill his frame with eye protein.
Ooh.
And I was like, stupid. It's dumb. Also, please explain Pacific Rim then. Like, because that movie is empty headed as they come. We'll talk about it, but there is.
Is that just.
What?
Is that just him, like, wanting to make a kaiju film or something?
Mean, it's just him, like, playing with action figures, right? Which is fine, but, like, he tries to sell his shit as more than what it is. I think that's my big problem with him, is that he tries to sell his films as much bigger than they are. And I think that I can kind of wrap my head around it, because I think that's the type of shit I would do if I made a movie. Like, I feel like I feel like he has a lot going on in his head of like what the movie is supposed to be, and then he's not great at communicating the overall theme of his stuff through it. And I don't want to knock him for that. I mean, I do, because that's not like, that's bad. Like, that's not, I mean, that's not great filmmaking. But I also understand that, because I feel like if I were to make a film, I would know exactly what's going on in my brain and what I wanted to say with it. And then I am very unconfident in my ability to get that out and communicate it clearly and effectively in a film, which is why I've never attempted to try to do that. you know, like, I feel like my knowledge of film would be better served in a classroom setting than it would making the actual things. And so, like, with when it comes to Guillermo, I would much rather take a film class with him and or, like, talk to him about movies than watch one of his movies.
That, even if I don't necessarily agree totally, that does make a lot of sense, because, like, he is one of those guys who is, like, so incredibly passionate about films. Mm-hmm. Like, it's clear this man loves movies, is incredibly knowledgeable about them, but it's like he takes that knowledge and puts it into his films, and that's a good thing sometimes, but also it's just like, are you just making films because you know a lot about films, or are you making films because you want your films to have something to say? And that's not to say that all of his films are like that, but I can totally understand that. It's like, I don't know if I necessarily put him into this category, but you know when you see a director called, like, by the visionary director, whatever. Mm-hmm. He's one of those. Yeah. He's spoken about as, like, a visionary director, mm-hmm. where I'm always kind of like, okay, is this, like, shorthand for good ideas, so-so execution? Mm-hmm. Or,
yeah,
like, I don't know. There's something weird about seeing that as, like, I can't think of other directors that... Darren Aronofsky, I think, is probably another one that gets called, like, a visionary director.
Hey, Tim Burton, at a certain point in his career, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yes, actually, yeah, very much so. So, yeah, that I'm always kind of like, I go into it a little more cautious than maybe I would with, like, certain other directors. Mm. And I don't think, to single out Del Toro, I don't think that he has had a completely, like, spotless filmography. I think that some of his films are okay, and I think that some of them are really, really great.
Right.
But yeah, I feel like we've gotten off of track.
We have,
a little
but
here. I mean,
like,
still relevant
okay.
to
so
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
To bring it back to the point, which is because, like, I feel like you can't talk about this movie without talking about Shape of Water because it's so much the same creature.
Be weird not to.
Yeah, but, like, to bring it back, Jack Arnold, what he does great is he has no pretensions about what the film is, right? Like, he's just like, mm-hmm. and I think that might be why they ended up choosing him to make that one blaxploitation movie with Fred Williamson, where it's like, okay, this guy gets it, right? Like, he's clearly talented and he's good. And that movie, the blaxploitation movie made, got pretty good reviews. Like, it was pretty well received. And it's somewhat important in the history of that genre. Like, it got a Blu-ray restoration in 2018. Like, that is still a movie that is influential for people who like exploitation movies. And that was 1974. This is 20 years after he made this, right? Like, he had no reason to keep making movies like that, but he was good at it. And he understood, like, it's a matter of understanding the assignment, I think. And he just, like, he got the script and was like, oh yeah, okay, I'm gonna make this look really lush and pretty and cast a bunch of hot people in it, and then we're off to the races, and that's all it's gonna be, right? Like, there's not a ton of thematic heft to this film whatsoever, and that's fine. Like, it is pure popcorn entertainment, and I think that's one of the best of the era. It's a shining example of what popcorn entertainment in the 1950s could be.
Yeah, and when The Blob was, what, 4 years
later
after this, right? I mean, it's and both, I think you could put into that, like, B movie category, but it's interesting to see one done so well and done as effectively as it is in Creature from the Black Lagoon, and then one that kind of, like, well, to us at least, like, falls short, but you can still see being influential. I mean, I think on that episode we spoke about the Spielberg elements of that as well, that there were things that Spielberg clearly could have taken away from a film like The Blob, like Creature from the Black Lagoon as well. But this kind of Creature from the Black Lagoon it does what Jaws does, right? I mean, Jaws does it even better, obviously, but it's that, like, taking this inspiration from these, like, other classic monster movies and then packaging it in something that is, like, really entertaining. Yeah. Like, incredibly entertaining. There is not one moment of Creature from the Black Lagoon where I was like, this is too long, or this is outstaying its welcome. I was like, this is great.
Yeah.
I would watch more mm-hmm. of this. Yes. Like, and the same with Jaws. Just, and even though Jaws is, you know, 40 minutes or whatever longer, you kind of never really feel that. You're not, because the pacing of it and everything is just so, I don't know, like well placed.
Yeah.
Like everything is working as it should be, all aspects, you know, writing, directing, acting, everything in that film is just working. And it's just like, it kind of is in this as well. It's just not, you know, you're more likely to see someone say their favorite film is Jaws and someone say their favorite film is Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Right.
But if someone said their favorite film was Creature from the Black Lagoon, I'd be like, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, and it still does have sort of the like masculinity stuff in it. It's not as explicit, but like you see different like modes of masculinity bouncing off each other in the film. It's not as interested mm-hmm. in exploring that aside from the fact of like dudes have conflict. But it's in there, right? Like it's not part
yeah.
of it. It just doesn't, it's not as central to the main story, which is what if there was a creature in a black lagoon?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Thelma is cut all this stuff out. Yeah, and that's not to say that there like there isn't stuff in this that you can sort of take away from it. I mean, like we said, that it carries a lot of weight that of similar things that we've seen in the three films that we've spoken about already, in terms of like who the real monster is, the kind of ethics and morals of like going into where a creature lives and then thinking that you can like conquer that monster. But I think that is us taking all of that stuff away from it with our like knowledge and modern eyes. And if we had done this film first, I'm not sure I would have taken all of that stuff
mm-hmm.
as much away from it as I have. And I think audiences seeing this in 1954 would not have been thinking about those things necessarily, or certainly not in the same way that they would with some of the other films that we've already spoken about. But that stuff is there. It's just not what this film is in. That's not what this film's intention is. This film's intention is to entertain.
Right.
And that's fine.
Yeah. It's entertaining as shit. Like, it's like, once again, it great for kids, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think there's anything in the design is a little creepy, and I think there's moments where a kid might be like, oh no, I don't like the fish man, but like I don't think there's anything that's gonna cause harm.
Mm-mm.
I think for like a seven plus
mm-hmm.
year old, I think there's actually quite a lot to take away from this. Like it's fun, it's well paced, it's enjoyable, like it's a great film.
Well, and it also like right, there's like I feel like people are like, well, you were either a space kid or a dinosaur kid. There's a third type of kid, and that's an ocean kid. And if you got an ocean kid, you absolutely got to show them Creature from the Black Lagoon. They're going to have a blast with it.
Yeah, and weirdly, this film kind of combines all three of those
mm-hmm.
because it's like an ancient creature,
mm-hmm.
like not dinosaur as we know a dinosaur, but
prehistoric.
Sort of like prehistoric, somewhat evolved from, you know, a bit more than a fish,
mm-hmm.
not quite a man sort of thing. And then you have the...
My favorite Britney Spears song.
Stupid.
Not a fish, not yet a man.
If we still did dumb titles for our episode, that would be it. Yes. I completely forgot my point. Okay, yeah. Space stuff, not quite. But there is a feeling of this otherworldliness
right.
about the creature. Because in this, like, untouched part of the Amazon, that this... they're going on an exploration as well. They're like, we don't know what exists in these corners of the world or in this lagoon, and we're going to find out. So there is elements of that as well, even if it's not like a guy from space. And then there's the ocean kids as well, or the, you know, the kids who are fascinated by like what's underwater. So it kind
mm-hmm.
of, Like, it takes... It takes. I'm still laughing about it. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm trying real hard not to think about it, too.
Everything's fine. Yeah, I don't know if there's much more to say
not
about
really.
This film. Like, it's really good, yeah. And I think that it has, pardon the pun, I guess, universal appeal, yeah, still in the same way of the other films we've spoken about have, and works particularly if you've got like a lovely Blu-ray copy or a 4K, even better. Like, it still
looks great.
It still works. It looks great. It looks modern. I could show this to someone now and you know, them still enjoy it and take as much away from it as I think he would have done back then.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's it's this sort of proto, and I mean this complimentary, it's this like proto Michael Bay type of film, right? Where there's like, there's nothing going on, but you go and like a bunch of shit happens in front of you and it looks pretty cool, and then you go home. Like, it's, there's nothing wrong with that kind of movie when it's done well. Like, I, you know, this might be a hot take, but like, I think all of Edgar Wright's output is largely style over substance, and I love that guy's movies. Like, what's the main theme of Hot Fuzz? Don't trust small towns? Like, there's not a lot going on in that movie thematically. No one's gonna tell you, yeah, that Hot Fuzz is a bad movie. Like, and if they do, you shouldn't trust their opinion about anything. Like, it, you know, I don't think that's as big of a knock as people think it is. Right? Like, style over substance can be cool. You know, one of my favorite Edgar Wright movies has a lot of problematic people in it now, was Baby Driver. That movie's a 2-hour music video, and that's it. And you know what? It's fucking rad. Like, it's super entertaining, it's really exciting, it's really tense, the car chases are amazing. Like, it's great, but like, there's nothing going on in that movie. It is so simple. And like, that's fine. That's allowed. Like, I mean, you know, a movie that's in the Criterion Collection that I love, A Hard Day's Night. You know what that movie is? What if there were Beatles? Like, that's this plot of the movie. There's nothing happens in A Hard Day's Night. There's an old man hanging out with the Beatles and Ringo is sad. That is the plot of the A Hard Day's Night. And it's hilarious.
It's great.
It's super entertaining, but like, that's it. I don't think there's a problem with popcorn entertainment when it's done well and when the style is so like soaked into the thing and it's done well and executed well. Like, there's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. And you know, I think it's great when we have films like Jaws or Jurassic Park where like thematically it brings out like way more thematic, or even Godzilla or King Kong. But the idea that like you can't just go be entertained for 2 hours in a movie, like I don't need every movie to be a potential Best Picture winner. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes you just need, you know, we're covering another one later on in the movie in the season, The Mummy. I don't think there's a lot thematically going on in that movie, really, but it's a lot of hot people in the desert having a big adventure. Like, and it's awesome.
A lot of hot people.
Yeah, everyone in that movie's hot. Everyone in this movie's hot, actually. There's a lot of hot people in this movie. And, like, they're all wet all the time. Like, he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, I think particularly having, like, what's the actor's name? Julie Adams, like, front and center of this. Smart.
Yeah.
Like, sex sells. Yeah. She's on the poster. Mm-hmm. She's like, yeah, you know that going into this, you're going to see, like, a weird fish man and a sexy lady, yeah, and that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, like, when you see him kidnap her, you're like, I mean, I get it, right? Like...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, to that point, there's... This movie came out during lockdown, so a lot of people didn't see it. Have you seen a movie called Love and Monsters? You gotta watch it. It's great. It's I gotta revisit that soon, especially now that we're doing like monster movie season. I should have suggested that for the patron episode. It is. Yeah, that's right. Okay. I knew someone I liked was in it. Or was in it, was behind the scenes. It's written by Brian Duffield, who made one of my favorite films of last year, which was No One Will Save You. Yeah, it's great. But you know what? It's mainly just a lot of cool kaiju shit, and that's it. And I think, well, I guess I can save it for a Pacific Rim episode, but there's a clear difference between, like, a movie that doesn't have a lot on its mind, like this, versus a movie that doesn't have a lot on its mind, like Pacific Rim, which is a film we're going to talk about on our Patreon in a couple months. And
Eesh.
What?
Eesh.
Yeah. And this type of movie that is more style over substance is like, That's what makes and breaks film fans. You know what I mean? Like, this is the exact type of movie that gets people to fall in love with movies, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think still one of the main entry points to, film fandom that, like, I think if you show a teenager today, they'll still be like, "This is the coolest movie I've ever seen," is Pulp Fiction. And like, I don't think there's a lot thematically. Like, it's just cool. It's just a lot of like cool looking shit and like cool people doing like sleazy stuff. Like, that's it. It's like pretty simple. You know, I guess you could say there's like some masculinity stuff going on in the Bruce Willis storyline, particularly in the pawn shop, but like,
yeah, the pursuit of something and sort of like not knowing what it is as well, or like the briefcase,
right?
And the,
yeah, I mean, yeah, yeah, like obviously I don't want to discourage people from doing deeper analysis on films like these, but like on the, like, you don't get all that after a first watch. You just watch Pulp Fiction and you're like, that was dope as hell. Like, that's it. Like, it's your initial reaction to a movie. Like, Heat, I think, is another movie where, like, there's a ton going on thematically in that movie. You know what most people think the first time they watch that movie? That was fucking rad. Like, that's the chief principle, like, the chief function of a film, right? Like, it can be as thematically hefty as you want it to be, but if it's not entertaining at the same time, I don't give a shit, right? Like, think about something like Mother. Like, Mother clearly has a lot in its mind. It's all stupid and it's dumb. It's like the atheism subreddit wrote a fucking movie. But, like, it's also not entertaining. So I don't give a shit about what that movie has to say.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that all of this could, like, kind of be applied to Jaws,
yeah.
And I don't want people to be like, oh, sacrilegious, like, turn this off, but like, a lot of people just like watch Jaws for the first time and are like, hella entertaining, that film, really enjoyed it, and it's only then after, I mean, that's the exact reaction I had when I first watched this film, because I was coming off the back of shark films like Deep Blue Sea, which was my gateway drug to Jaws. And then I watched Jaws and was like, that was fun. Mm. I enjoyed that. Very entertaining. And then I'm thinking about things afterwards and I'm not thinking about the shark moments. I'm thinking about other things. Mm. But I didn't, like, I couldn't have done a minute by minute breakdown podcast of Jaws after watching it one time, because the first time I watched it, I was like, cool movie.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed that. And that's fine. And then some people will never revisit that film and they'll just have happy memories of enjoying a really like good time and a fun time, and that's fine. But the fact is, there is obviously more to Jaws than that. And I imagine if we did a Let's Creature from the Black Lagoon for a minute, that we would probably find like a bunch more stuff in there, because the longer you spend with something, the more stuff you find in it, although there isn't necessarily the same
I would say
level.
Yeah, I would say that if we were to do like a Let's Creature from the Black Lagoon for a minute, it would be more focused on the making of the film rather than analysis of it, because the people who are nerdy about this movie are nerdy about the making of this film.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Like, there are definitely creature from the Black Lagoon. Like, that is their boy, right? Like, that is their monster of choice. And the reason mm-hmm. they usually are into it is because of, like, the sheer movie magic that the film encompasses.
Which I can understand mm-hmm. because I mean, sound like a broken record. I have that with Jaws as well, though, because it's just like, I obviously, as a super fan, it's just like, obviously we kind of like focused on the analysis, mm-hmm. but I'm also very interested in the making of that because it is like, it is mm-hmm. magic. It like what they're able to do and the effects they're able to create and stuff. But yeah, I see what you mean. Like with Creature from the Black Lagoon specifically, I think that there are people who are nerdy about it, and that's great. It doesn't surprise me at all. Like, I want to get nerdy about this film. I want to read I want to read those books, yeah. And it's particularly about like the effects and stuff, because I'm so fascinated with the how mm-hmm. of old movies like this, because I'm just like, you didn't have what we have now, and like, it's incredible that you managed to make something mm-hmm. that looks as good as this does and is as effective as this is with, you know, no special effects really, or limited, or, you know, I mean, think how like how nerdy we got about King Kong and all of the cool effects and stuff in that. We were giddy with excitement yeah. talking about that film because it's just so cool. It's so cool to like to learn the how and the why of these early films, these films that are so influential on all the other films that we love.
Yeah. Yeah, good movie.
Pretty good. Pretty good movie. Interestingly, this placing this film in our seasons is how we've mapped them out. This could fit into so many of those. It was, I think, originally in the films that influenced Spielberg category mm-hmm. that we've got. It was also in the films that influenced Jaws. I think that was probably it, and then when we sort of decided to do this monster movie season, felt like it slotted nicely into that. But I just goes to show of how much of this there is in Jaws in particular. I think if people haven't seen Creature from the Black Lagoon, you're listening to this probably because you like us and you like yeah. Jaws. So you gotta go and watch this film. You'll have such a good time with it. It's great.
Yeah.
Some other people think it is great. Also, we had some tweets. So let me just get Twitter in the background just in case anyone else has said anything in the meantime. But a few people got in touch. So at Dan Ross Artist said, classic monster flick, visually stunning. And at Jarak said, an excellent example of the genre and still looks great. Not sure if style or budget led to filming in black and white, but it paid off. Julia Adams was a highlight. Quality performance from an actress I knew from the westerns. Yeah, I don't know if it was a style or budget decision about black mm-hmm. and white, but I imagine a style thing. I guess like I feel like in color you could pick apart the look of the creature more.
I wonder if it had to do with like the 3D.
That's a good point. Yeah. Interestingly, even though I don't think that like 3D players or TVs are really a thing anymore, mm-hmm. the Blu-ray that I've got has got the 3D version.
Oh, wow.
On it.
Wow.
But you have to, it says, so there's like a little asterisk that's like, must have a 3D enabled player mm-hmm. and TV and glasses. So I'm like, okay. If I could like go to like a theater screening of this in 3D, I'd be curious. I don't think it would necessarily, it's not Jaws 3D. Right. Like, there's not moments in it where you go, oh, I could see that, like how they've deliberately crafted that to look cool is a loose term when it comes to Jaws 3D,
sure.
But they've crafted it to look like something in 3D.
Yep.
Where, and in this, I guess it would, for a lot of 3D, I find it just adds depth and just adds a kind of, there's not things like popping out of the screen at you like a gimmicky sort of thing that doesn't really happen in this film. So I guess it's just, it probably adds some depth to particularly the water scenes, or I don't know.
You know, I didn't mention this, but the first time I saw this movie was in a theater.
Oh. Mm-hmm. I hadn't twigged that this wasn't a first watch for you, but then you did say it.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I've seen it before, but that's good. It's real entertaining.
Yeah, this is a drive-in would be so fun.
Yeah, this and Frankenstein made me realize that I really want to just plow through my 4K sets of. I've seen half of them now. I've seen Dracula a bunch. I've seen Frankenstein now. I've seen Creature twice, and I've seen Bride of Frankenstein before I owned the 4K set. But I'm really I'm really keen to watch that movie on 4K. Then Wolfman, Invisible Man, The Mummy, and Phantom of the Opera, I've not seen.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen the old Phantom of the Opera, the silent one, but that's not the one that's on the 4K. Mm.
Yeah, I am curious to watch the rest of these now. I wish we were doing more classic, or just doing more monster movies on our
We could have.
I'm enjoying this season so much.
We could have done a Universal Monsters, because Universal's the studio.
We could have done. I mean, never too late to add more seasons to our spreadsheet. That's true. So, although it might end up being a mini season at this point.
Yeah.
Put a pin in that thought. It's quite a good idea.
Yep.
I mean, we've got four Spielberg seasons because man's made so many movies. So maybe we can just do three monster movie seasons because we're having so much fun. But our next patron episode, I believe, is
Colossal,
which we are taking a real time jump with our next couple of films, aren't we? So we'll be doing American Werewolf in London. Is our next film for the main series, and then Colossal on Patreon. But you can become a patron if you would like to listen to all of our bonus content. So you get roughly one extra episode a month, but you get access to all the other ones that we've done previously. There's interviews, there's Jaws commentary, all kinds of fun stuff. I would say Patreon is like normal LJ fam, sometimes a little bit more unhinged. We're just a little, based on this episode, I don't know. But we're a little more loosey-goosey.
Not a fish, not yet a man.
I just forgot about that. Okay, right. If you would like to become a patron, you can go to patreon.com/jawsforaminute, like these fine folks did. Tim, Eric, Blake, Andrew, Rachel, Katie, Mike, Callum, Cameron, Jack, Chris, and the Uncut Gems podcast. Huge thank you to all of our patrons. MJ is very close to being able to buy his new microphone. Yes. Thanks to you. Thanks to you guys. But without being flippant, we really, really appreciate you guys, your guys' support. And we love making those patron episodes as well. They're always a lot of fun. So if you want access to those and various other cool things and a shout out on the show as well, that is where you need to go to do that.
Yep. If you like this and want this but slightly more educated, you can go check out our other podcasts. Sarah and I have a second podcast called Let's Party with Marty. It is a Martin Scorsese podcast, and it is about his Letterboxd list, as well as his own films. So we're watching the films he has chosen as companion films to his own, as well as the corresponding film that he chose to be a companion with. What's up next? Is it Alice Doesn't Live Here, our next episode?
Yes. At time of recording this. Yes.
Okay.
Sorry, my schedule is all over the
place. Yeah, we're a little ahead on the recording of that, but spoilers, good movie. It is, if this is what this is, and the patron is this but slightly more chaotic, this is Let's Party with Marty is this but slightly more academic, although still quite fun, I think.
Still silly.
Yeah. Yeah, never not going to get rid of the silliness from us. I saw someone earlier send a tweet that said, I need you to be serious for a minute. And it said me, no, this is a load-bearing coping mechanism. You're not getting rid of the sense of humor. and I was like, yeah, it's me.
Just two silly little guys.
Yeah. yep, you can find this show on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Jaws for a Minute. There you will find a link tree in our bio, which will get you a link to the Patreon, as well as links to listen to the show and buy merch for both shows through TeePublic. And yeah, both our logos, or all three of our designs, I guess we have four designs that you can choose from. They're all
With the text mm-hmm. only.
They're all real good. So shout out to Alex, mm-hmm. our graphic designer, for the work on that. And yeah, you can find us individually on Twitter at Sarah Buttery, SarahBuddery, and at MJSmith891. If you are not on the socials, congratulations on being better than us. You can email us at jawsforaminute@gmail.com with any thoughts, feedback, etc. Until next time, it's Jaws O'Clock somewhere.